You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, August 31st, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Richard Alba, distinguished professor of sociology at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York, to discuss his recent book, The Great Demographic Illusion, Majority, Minority, and the Expanding American Mainstream. Also on the program today, U.S. ends its longest war. The U.S. occupation of Afghanistan ends after costing more than 240,000 lives, more than 70,000 of which were civilians. 2,500 U.S. service members over, I should say. Meanwhile, the U.N. Security Council urges the Taliban to allow travel and aid in and out of the country. In the wake of Ida, New Orleans struggles without power. As we get a lesson about climate change and our failing infrastructure, the U.S. Department of Education is now investigating five states over their mask mandate bans, over federal disability law, discrimination laws. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court may let Texas overturn Roe v. Wade in the next 48 hours by simply doing nothing. A Goldman Sachs report shows that without eviction ban from the federal government, up to 750,000 households could be evicted over the course of the next 6 or 7 months. Starbucks workers in Buffalo start a union drive that's going to target individual Starbucks. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. We've got a lot to get to today. I'm here with Emma Viglin. Hello, Emma. How are you?
Hello, Sam. I'm well. How about you?
I'm doing okay. This is a pretty big day, or I should say, yesterday, today,
today's time, the deadline.
Exactly.
Right. And it's late in Afghanistan.
We have evacuated Afghanistan after a 20-year folly that killed hundreds of thousands of people. Nearly 100,000 of whom were civilians.
We should also say over 5 million Afghans displaced, nearly 6 million.
Both external and internal refugees. And leaving the place not in a too dissimilar fashion than we found it in terms of the control of the country. To the extent that people are focusing on the Biden administration's failures in getting people out of the country earlier, I think there's some validity in that. But overall, it is good that we're getting out of the country. And then certainly maybe they should have been less timid about bringing in refugees earlier and more often. The evacuations of people was nearly 300,000 by the end of this couple week period. And here is the head of the Central Command in Afghanistan, Kenneth McKenzie, at a Pentagon press conference with Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby. This is from yesterday. This is their announcement.
I'm here to announce the completion of our withdrawal from Afghanistan in the end of the military mission to evacuate American citizens. third country nationals, and vulnerable Afghans. The last C-17 lifted off from Hamid Karzai International Airport on August 30th, this afternoon, at 3:29 p.m. East Coast time. And the last manned aircraft is now clearing the airspace above Afghanistan.
And so it ends. The 20-year war, I guess shy of a couple months, a month and a half or so. There's going to be a lot of, there's a lot of talk on right-wing radio and right-wing media focusing on the deaths of the 13 Marines who got blown up in a suicide bombing attack outside of the Kabul airport. Of course, there were also dozens of Afghan civilians who were also killed in that explosion. And then in our response, we ended up killing almost a dozen children and almost two dozen other civilians in a sort of, I don't know, a horrible poetic I guess
crystallization of our time in Afghanistan, right?
Indeed.
Encore.
More Afghans die in a a suicide bombing. They get no coverage in the press, and then the United States government retaliates in a strike that kills more Afghans because, yeah, there's no way to do a clean war, no matter how advanced your drone systems are. It's always going to kill children. And so, like, if you're looking for meaning and a silver lining in this withdrawal, there is none. There is none.
It is fascinating to me, too. I mean, I was listening to some right-wing radio this morning, and to listen to, in an era where we've had hundreds of thousands of Americans who have died, like literally every day, you hear of stories of people who died saying, I wish I would have taken the vaccine. I didn't believe this was real. From the same right-wing radio hosts, talkers, who are talking about the their vaccine hesitancy or skepticism or, who would initially call
ivermectin.
COVID a hoax. And they're talking about, they're very much focused on these 13 Marines. It's just sort of a...
Well, I
just
mean,
noted.
It's a cudgel to attack Biden.
Of course.
He looked at his watch. I don't know if you guys heard about this. It's a very, very big deal.
And I think it is, you know, there is, they want to make him pay for pulling out of Afghanistan. That's the bottom line. The media, and not just the right-wing media.
Certainly not.
There is just a real thirst for war and occupation in this country. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Richard Alba on his new book, The Great Demographic Illusion, Majority Minority in the Expanding American Mainstream. We'll be right back in just a moment. Got a couple of sponsors on today's program. I don't know if you're still going to the post office or if you're still paying full price for postage, but you don't have to do that, thanks to Stamps.com. You can mail and ship anytime, anywhere, right from your computer. You can send letters, you can ship packages, you can pay less with discounted rates from USPS, it's the post office, and UPS, and more. All you got to do is you use your computer, you print official U.S. postage. You can do it at 2 in the morning. You can do it at 2 in the afternoon. You can do it at every time in between. In other words, 24/7. Sunday? Yeah, no problem. You can do it for any letter. You can do it for any package. You can do it for any class of mail. And you can do it for anywhere you want to send it to. Stamps.com, you get discounts up to 40% off post office rates and up to 66% off UPS shipping rates. Stamps.com saves businesses thousands of hours and tons of money every year. It's no wonder nearly 1 million small businesses already use Stamps.com. Stop wasting time going to the post office and go to Stamps.com instead. There's no risk, and with my promo code Majority Report, you get a special offer that includes a four-week trial plus free postage and a digital scale. There is no long-term commitments, no contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, type in Majority Report. That's stamps.com, promo code Majority Report. Stamps.com, you'll never have to go to the post office again. Also, in preparation for my return to the program this week after vacation.
Shaved.
It's been a couple of days, not gonna lie, but you can shave with the same blade that made me, well, at least 2 days ago, clean shaven. And you don't have to choose between a great shave and a fair price, because that's where our friends at Harry's comes in. You now, you can redeem a Harry's trial set when you go to harrys.com/majority. You've heard me talk about Harry's for years now. It delivers a close shave, comfortable shave, and it does so at a very fair price. Still as low as $2 per blade. Their blades are designed to stay sharp. In a recent study, guys who shave four times a week said their eighth shave was as smooth as their first. So for me, that lasts you almost half the year.
Well,
that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but maybe close. Harry's blades are crafted in their very own German factory. Their design team combines a weighted ergonomic handle with their signature blade cartridge. Plus, they got a 100% money-back guarantee on harrys.com. I love the handle. Simple, clean look. The blades got the narrow blade head. Very important with my asymmetric nostrils. We've gone into that big time around here. Harry's has given their best offer to the Majority Report listeners. New Harry customers can redeem a starter set. You get a 5-blade razor, get a weighted handle, foaming shave gel with aloe, and a travel cover to protect your blades when you're on the go. That's a $13 value for just $3. There's truly never been a better time to try Harry's. Go to harrys.com/majority to try Harry's today. And lastly, it's been a while since we've had an ad from these guys, and their stuff is great. I've checked out all of their furniture over literally right around the corner. There's a showroom, but Joybird offers modern customizable furniture for every space. It's available in a variety of vibrant, durable fabric options. And it's finally here, folks. You can shop Joybird's Labor Day sale and take advantage of their biggest savings of the season starting August 27th. It's a couple of days ago at joybird.com. You can choose from over 18,000 customization options. And you can browse their curated collections and you can find the perfect piece for your style. Joybird's design specialists are standing by to make your vision a reality for free. Joybird is committed to creating quality furniture and a more sustainable future. Their pieces are made using responsibly sourced materials, and they are free of harmful chemicals. They have partnerships with groups like One Tree Planted. Joybird is helping conservation efforts. With Joybird, you get quality craftsmanship, stain and scratch resistant fabrics, and a limited lifetime warranty. Joybird stands by its quality. They have a 90-day return. If it's not everything you hope for, you send it back. Check it out, folks. I've been getting a lot more sort of sensitive to style. I'm starting to like throw a lot of stuff out. I'm starting to say, like, you know what? This couch that I've been patching up, no, not going to do it. Check out Joybird. This stuff is really great.
I've been eyeing it for a while. I got to be honest. I love the aesthetic of the accent chairs. I'm going to save up for one in my new place.
Yeah, they're not too minimalist, but they're modern. I like it.
I really like it.
Create a space that brings you joy with Joybird. Visit joybird.com/majority. Get 35% off your purchase. That's 35% off at joybird.com/majority. 35%
That's
off.
That's significant.
I don't know. Well, that was a lot. 35% off joybird.com/majority. Big sale. All right. Want to welcome to the program Professor Richard Alba. He is a distinguished professor of sociology at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. His most recent book is The Great Demographic Illusion, Majority, Minority, and the Expanding American Mainstream. Professor, welcome to the program. I'm here with Emma Biglin.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, Sam. Really looking forward to our conversation.
Yeah, I am too, because, you know, years ago, when I started my political talk radio career, I had read a book right around that time. It was back in, I think it must have been like 2004, entitled The Emerging Democratic Majority. It was by
Roy Teixeira and John Judis. Yes, I know that. I know that argument. Yeah.
No, I mean, in many
ways. So what happened? Right.
Right. Exactly. I mean, this was the and the argument. I mean, your book reminded me immediately of that book, because that argument was largely, not totally, but that in many respects, demography is destiny in terms of politics, and B, the demography is in favor of the Democratic Party. Let's just start with that, with the narrative that is built around that.
That's actually a very good starting point. I don't know if you noticed, but John Judis actually had an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal yesterday, which in a way took back that argument. And I'm really not sure that either Teixeira or Judis would stand by that argument as it's been commonly understood today, because we see a lot of changes that really don't resonate well with that argument. And let me say, as a starting point, and so that people don't misunderstand, there's a fundamental paradox about American society that continues today, and that is that American society visits racism on some and grants the possibility of assimilation to others. And that was certainly true, you know, in the middle of the 20th century, when the despised, once despised Irish Catholics, Jews, and Italians were able to join the mainstream. And it continues, I think, to be true today, although maybe not quite to the same extent. But one sign of that assimilation is the tremendous amount of mixing that's taking place in families that crosses these major ethno-racial divisions. And, you know, one sign of that is intermarriage, which has been kind of going up very steadily, sort of ratcheting upward. And I follow the Pew Research Center in this respect, and their last measure is that of marriages taking place recently, 20% roughly, cross these divisions, and most of them, the big majority, involve a white partner and a minority partner. And the same reverberates in the child population. So we have a growing number of children who come from these mixed ethno-racial family backgrounds, whether they involve marriage or not. And, you know, we know that 1 in 7 children today born in the United States has parents from 2 different ethno-racial backgrounds. So all of this is a kind of signal. It's not all of the assimilation in and of itself, but it's a signal that there are kind of assimilation processes that are ongoing. I think that has potentially big political impacts that work against the argument that Judis and Teixeira made. And we can already see that. I mean, you look at the electoral data from 2020, and one of the surprises was the degree to which Latinos and Asians, but even African Americans, voted for Trump.
Well, and also,
I'm sorry. I want to go back, because you have a redefinition of assimilation, but a redevelopment of that term on some level.
Yes, that's fair. Yeah, absolutely.
And before we get there, though, I want to go back to that sort of to the narrative that is that has been at least somewhat controlling over the past 20, 30 years, which has been this idea that I'm trying to figure out. The idea has been that we're headed towards a minority-majority society.
Actually, it's usually put the other way around, but I can understand majority-minority. It's confusing. It's a confusing term.
But that statement in of itself is not correct because it miscategorizes yes. or it sort of like
yeah. All right, let me unpack it a bit, if please. I may. So I think the majority minority society, which is, by the way, according to Census Bureau projections, supposed to take place before the middle of the 20th century, is really very misleading as a way of thinking about the future that's emerging. And so it envisions a society that truly is riven into two parts. We have whites on the one hand and people of color on the other hand. And there's no room in that binary for the emerging group of people who have a foot in both camps, as it were, because they have a white parent and a non-white parent. That's a big growing group. There's no reason to think it's going to stop growing. And it just doesn't fit into this vision. Now, the demographic data on which the majority-minority vision is based, as you say, misclassify people because they treat all people of mixed backgrounds as part of the people of color population. And it's not that they're white, but it's that they're also not people of color. I mean, they're really kind of in between. The evidence shows that many of them, there's a huge exception that I'll get to in a second, are really integrating into social environments that may be diverse but also contain many whites. They have very high rates of marriage to people who are whites. Now, the big exception are people who are part black and part white. And, you know, they're an exception because the burden of systemic racism in our society falls most heavily on people of African descent. And, you know, that is an enduring sore in our social flesh, as it were, and one that still really needs to be remedied.
So, all right. And so, in other words, let me just sum up where we're at this point. To the extent that demography is destiny, which I guess on some level you could say at least demography is predictive, it can be predictive, but we are not really getting the classification of demography correct. And we're not assessing, we do not have the nuance.
Yeah.
In the way that we talk about these things, to understand the implications of what's happening in this respect, because people of color that we refer to as people of color and black people are not similarly situated necessarily
correct.
In this country in a yeah. myriad of ways.
That's correct. Yes.
And so that's really that's where we are at this point.
Let me work against the demography as destiny idea because okay. it really doesn't fit very well here. You know, it's one thing if you say, you know, the age structure is changing and in this respect, demography is destiny. But it's a very different thing when you say that the kind of ethno-racial configuration of the population is changing, because that treats these group memberships as if they were fixed. And they are not fixed. I mean, our history is very clear in teaching us, you know, that the boundaries of who is us changes. And I think that we're in another moment where the boundary of who is us is changing to allow a mainstream, that's what I call it in the book, that is at least in some parts of America a lot more diverse than it was, say, at the end of the 20th century. And the mixing is a signal of, you know, this growing diversity among, let's say, that involves whites, but also involves a lot of people who are not white necessarily, but who see each other as alike and, you know, who mingle together and, you know, form romances and have children and families together.
Right. And I mean, part of, I think, what some of the errors are in these classifications is that it treats whiteness as like a static definition, right? We've
seen it
about throughout history, Italians weren't necessarily considered white. It changes to, I think, fit hegemonic structures in order to maintain a bit of a perception of white supremacy, however threadbare that perception may be, in terms of just the fact that things are changing demographically.
Okay, so forgive me if I push back a tiny bit on that. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I think that when the kind of mainstream part of society opens up, we don't really know where we're going. And it's not true, I think, that sort of the – I mean, power is clearly a part of all this, absolutely, no question. But I don't think that this kind of process of opening up is really that controllable. And let me use the following example. So if we went back to the 1950s, we would find a mainstream that was white Christian, meaning really Protestant, and that looked down – you know, on Jews and Catholics, especially, by the way, on the latter, because they were so numerous and they were so politically important. And, you know, the fear of many white Protestants in the early part of the 20th century and into the 1950s was Catholic control of democracy, because Catholics were believed to be, you know, like Muslims today, you know, people who obeyed religious dictates and therefore were not really suitable democratic members of a free society. And, you know, you remember, I'm sure, that that when Kennedy was a candidate, he had to appear before this big group of Protestant ministers to assure them that he was not going to be ruling in favor of the Pope's policies. So today, every branch of our government is you know, led by an observant Catholic. That's true for Biden, that's true for Pelosi, and that's true for John Roberts in the Supreme Court. No one has remarked on this, at least not to my knowledge. If, you know, people viewing this from the 1950s would have thought, oh, my God, this, you know, this is the worst outcome that could happen in American society. And now progressives think, well, you know, Pelosi, she's OK. And Biden, well, he's OK. I mean, it's, you know, I think we don't know. What I'm trying to say is that the differences that loom so large at one historical moment may not be very important at a later historical moment, and that white Christians, Protestants, were not able to maintain control of this process of integration that began in the post-World War II period.
Don't you think that the whiteness is so
well, that's the way it looks today.
Certainly,
that's looking from through our through our lenses today. That's not the way it looked in the 1950s. I mean, you have to take into account that, okay, so Catholics were not slaves for sure, but religion was an extremely important social distinction through much of American history. Yeah,
I totally understand that. I just don't want to like approach or think about, as white people, this kind of change to be more inevitable or...
Well, it's not inevitable. I agree with that. Absolutely.
White supremacy is certainly, a larger mountain to climb.
Okay. That's a very fair statement. But I still say that what's going on is a process of overt diversity within what we view as mainstream America. And we can see it, like in many cultural domains, in music, and even, I think, more consequential as a kind of indicator, because there's so much capital involved, in movies. It's just, you know, compare the selection of movies that Americans are watching today against that even in 2010. There's so much more diversity and so many more movies that are coming forward that represent not sort of people of color as seen by whites, but people of color as seen by people of color. I think it's, I think we're really, this is really a watershed, and I think we need to sort of appreciate it and build. I agree with you. Build on this growing diversity, not take it for granted.
So, I mean, but there's two things going on here, particularly in the context of, and you make the distinction between in the context of immigrant groups and on one level or in one way and black people and indigenous people in this country.
Correct.
And we are, on one hand, you're right. I mean, I think this week actually was we've had the first top grossing film in the world directed by a black woman. I think that happened this week.
And we had Black Panther a few years ago, which.
Yes, right. And but simultaneously, we're also looking when, you know, that is. I mean, I suppose that's good.
Which movie is this?
I don't know. Okay. I'm not that savvy, but but at the same time, we also have reports that have come out just in the past couple of months about black people's college educations don't have the same value as white people's. That black people with BA, their incomes have not risen. They have been completely static. And I guess to some extent, you know, like in the exchange you just had with Emma, I hear there's two things. One is we can't know the future, and things that we thought were immutable in the past have mutated. But the other is that on some level, it feels like American history is a process of negotiation of like, you know what? We can relax this as long as we maintain this specific underclass on some level. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're willing to, you know, there's a negotiation.
We can accept Italians okay. in now.
Right. Okay, yeah. Well, so, but let's follow that thread through, because I think that's what you've said is very, I agree with, and is very insightful. So we have growing diversity, but it's true that what you say, that much of it has to do with immigrant populations, because our, you know, as Americans, almost all of us have been immigrants. Many of us, you know about the immigrant experience firsthand from people that, you know, the older people that we knew when we were young, and we kind of understand the immigrant experience, and it kind of, there's a bias in favor of immigrants as people who chose to come here in order to better their lives. And that's a story that runs through a lot of our families. We have a lot more trouble with understanding the kind of the post-emancipation racism that has held back, you know, African Americans, and also in, you know, and understanding the incredible impact of the genocide and concentration of American Indians on reservations. And so I think that members of those groups, but especially African Americans, experience much more difficulty in kind of entering this mainstream than do, let's say, socially affluent Asians and Hispanics and light-skinned, you know, Hispanics. There's, you know, there are all kinds of biases that are occurring, I agree, in this process. But nevertheless, we have to acknowledge that this process is expanding what we think of as the us. And we can build on that expansion, in my opinion.
And what is the, I mean, like, who is the... What we in that us, like,
well, the we is the, I mean, you know, I think the we, let's see, I mean, here's where power comes in. So, of course, I mean, we are in a hierarchical society where whites are the dominant group. And so the we really that these others moving up are mixing with is we as whites. You know, this is, you know, I'm not trying to say, oh, this is wonderful and all our problems are going to be solved. I'm trying to take a realistic view of how a certain kind of social change is occurring with an eye toward building out from that social change.
So let's talk a little bit about the, you know, one of the things that people have speculated about, and there's, I think you cite some research as well in the book about the implications of the message that we're headed towards a majority minority society. It creates essentially it supercharges white racial anxiety, I guess.
Yes, it does. I mean, I think there's convincing social psychological research on this. And, you know, a Yale social psychologist, Jennifer Richardson, and her colleagues have really been in the lead in demonstrating that when you prompt whites with, you know, some kind of signal about demographic change and what it might do to the white majority position, many of them, not just conservatives, many of them become anxious. They adopt more conservative political opinions. They express more racial resentment. And I think a lot of the political science that has analyzed the outcome of the 2016 election has found that one of the driving forces was working class white racial resentment that, you know, is affiliated with in some way this sense of a loss of white's position in American society. So I see this as a divisive story. And of course, it's divisive in its very nature because it says that society is made up of these two great blocks, one of which is whites, and the white part is shrinking and the other part is growing. So I don't think it's a healthy way. I think it's an incorrect way, but it's also an unhealthy way to view the kinds of social changes that are taking place in the U.S. today.
And the incorrect part about it is simply that there is something happening that is really, I guess it may, maybe it sounds a little bit, it's a little bit trite, but it's really sort of becoming a little bit more melty pot.
Yes, a little melty.
Than being sort of a binary question. I think there was at one point you spoke about data that showed second generation immigrants, if I remember correctly, had sort of outperformed, and then third generation immigrants had suddenly the progress had stopped, and it was
That's a little confusing, isn't it?
It wasn't a question of the progress or had stopped. It was a question of how people began to identify themselves.
Oh, that's true. So one of the things that's happening. So this has been a big issue in the study of Latinos, especially Mexican Americans. And so the argument has been that Latino progress stalls in the third generation. But what a lot of research has shown, I mean, here I'll bring in the University of Texas economist Steve Trejo and his colleague Brian Duncan, and they've done a lot of research that shows that at least a part of this story is that the some Mexican Americans in the third generation are no longer thinking of themselves as somehow. Or they don't really, that's not so important to them anymore. They don't identify themselves on census data in that way necessarily. And these tend to be better educated. This goes along, by the way, with a lot of research now from Pew and from others showing that over the generations, Latino identities fade. And Latinos, I mean, they're not denying that they're Latinos necessarily, but they tend to identify themselves more as American than as Latino American.
Which is what happens with immigrants in general, or the children of all immigrants in general, less connected from. It's interesting that I feel like maybe some of the research that, you know, you looked at, they don't seem to take that into account. It's more just based on Is this your last name? Is this your skin color? Is this how we classify you, I guess?
Right. That's right, actually. And so, again, you know, this speaks to the problem in treating demography as destiny is that you have to view these categories that we put people into as kind of fixed identities that don't change and aren't fluid. And that's really contrary to what's going on for a lot of people.
I mean, this just reinforces the notion that in many respects, and certainly at least in the context of certain cohorts of people, that race or ethnic ethnicity is wholly constructed, and it can be constructed differently by different perspectives, right? I mean, the census can have one perspective on what an ethnicity is, and the individuals who the census purports to be counting may have a different perspective on what their identity is.
Well, almost certainly that's true. I mean, the census data, we have to accept, are a limited kind of set of lenses for looking at our population in this respect. And I think they're particularly weak on capturing change. And, you know, part of it is that they fit people into mutually exclusive boxes. So you can be mixed race, but you can't be part. I mean, they don't, these boxes don't reflect how important are the whites to this mixing, for example. So the decline in the white population in 2020 is actually partly a function of census methodological changes. So the census correctly decided that it wasn't doing a good job of identifying mixed race people. So it changed its classification principles for 2020. And in 2020, for the first time, under white and black, you could write in ethnic labels. And it scrutinized these ethnic labels, and it reclassified people as mixed when they used a label that belonged to another racial category. So, for example, we know from past research that a lot of people who come from Asian white backgrounds often on the census identify themselves as white only. And so now, you know, they're encouraged to write in labels. And so they might write in, you know, this is Irish, German, Korean. And so the census, Korean, you're also Asian, therefore you're mixed race. So it moved people out of the solely white category into the mixed race category. And as a consequence, it appeared there was an exaggeration of whatever white decline might have occurred was really exaggerated in census data because of this. So the census defines people as white on a very narrow basis. You have to be non-Hispanic and solely white by race. And that's the group that fell. But if you say, okay, let's look at people who are partly white as well as only white, those groups increased in numbers, though not dramatically. I mean, just very slightly. But they didn't fall. You know, the big story of the first fall in the white population since 1790 actually hinges on a very narrow definition of whiteness.
So it had the census used the 2010 definition of whiteness. Do we have a sense of like what that story would have been if
we can't say exactly because of the limits of the data that have been released, but I'm sure that the decline, if any, would have been very small.
Okay. And so, you know, largely what we're looking about in this story is, I mean, there's sort of like, I mean, that's the story of, or at least one of the stories of the 2020 census, is that we're looking, some of what has come out of that in terms of a story is more a function of just reclassification.
Correct.
Than it is actual changes in demographics.
So it looked like the mixed population exploded, but that's because the census deliberately did a better job measuring the mixed population. Of course, from my perspective, that is an important group, and it is growing, but not quite in the way that the census described.
So as far as like what this perspective on what's happening with our demographics, that there's more fluidity in the way that people perceive their identities, and fluidity in terms of the way they identify within the categories that are presented to them, but also all the things that we glean from that, or social sciences glean from that,
yes.
Right? I mean, that's where things start to break down with the emerging Democratic majority thinking, or the idea of demography as destiny thinking, and where we are today is that this stuff is a far more fluid, and they're not really the utility of these classifications as proxies for something else,
yes,
are just simply not as effective as we have assumed.
I think, well, that's a good way to put it. And I would say this, that, you know, I think that if we would tell ourselves a different narrative about current social change and what it implies about the future, not the majority minority, but something that is more comprehensible in terms of the American past of assimilation, that the reaction would not be, among many whites, would not be as nationalistic as it is to the majority-minority story. We have very good research on this, too, done by Morris Levy and Dal Myers of USC, and they've tested different narratives in social psychological experiments to see how people respond to them. And the response to the mainstream is changing and people are mixing more is very different from the response to whites are destined to become a minority in a couple of decades. So I'm not saying this is the solution to all our political problems by any means, but I do think it's important to correct the story because it's at least a tile, you know, in a mosaic that could bring us to a better place.
And it's also important to correct the story because the story's wrong.
And that's why no disagreement on that point.
Right. I mean, to the extent that we can get, I mean, can we get a handle on this, or is it, I mean, is there, if you apply your lens essentially to this type of data where you understand that and you were to try and capture this demography to the extent that you can, can it function as a proxy, or is it basically telling us that we need another set of proxies that class is more effective?
Okay. Well, I think, I'm not certainly not going to dispute the importance of inequality. I mean, that's an inequality that isn't simply aligned with racial origin is really, really important in our society, for sure. And I think it's also, you know, as you implied earlier with your statement about as long as, you know, we have an underclass of subordinates, we're okay. Inequality is impeding the kind of social mobility that leads to more integration of people of disparate origins at the top of American society. So we certainly want to address that, as well as to address, you know, the tremendous forces in our society, such as wealth inequality, that are holding African Americans back.
So you address some of the social policies to expand assimilation. I know you just have a couple of minutes here, but could you elaborate on those just a little bit?
Well, you know, I think there are three fundamental dimensions. One is the economic inequality, which is much higher today than it was in the middle of the 20th century when we had our last great episode of expansion of the mainstream. And, you know, at the other is the racial inequality that exists between lighter-skinned and darker-skinned Americans, to put it very broadly. But we know from the study of African Americans that that has a lot of different mechanisms involved that we could address. And one of the big ones is wealth inequality. And you know, we understand how government policy over the 20th century prevented African Americans from accumulating wealth to the same extent that white families were able to accumulate wealth through homeownership, for instance. And of course, the other part of the African American problem is the coercive or the oppressive forces of the criminal justice system. And I talk about it in the book. I'm not an expert, but obviously, you know, something needs to be done. And then finally, I think with immigrants, we have to understand that the legal distinctions among the foreign-born people residing in our country today don't have a parallel in our past. We didn't have any kind of sizable undocumented population, you know, before really the 1960s. And we need to remedy this, which, I mean, it's really a wound in our democracy that so many people are, you know, in the shadows of illegality, even young people who have grown up here and know really no other society but the United States are sometimes in these shadows.
So I guess lastly, you know, I'm thinking, you know, I every day I come into work and we have a handful of clips from Tucker Carlson essentially promoting the idea that, you know, white people are going to be replaced in this country. It changes, to be fair, day to day as to who's going to be doing the replacing. This week, it's just Afghans that are going to be replacing white people and changing the political makeup.
All 100,000 of them that we might in principle accept. Yes,
exactly. Right. Well, they're going to be placed in Key in Ouachita County, apparently, or something like that. But so that story is both wrong and destructive.
Very, and
it's hyper polarizing. And it helps for those of us who don't want a right-wing country or more of a right-wing country than we have, let's say, or want to end the right-wing nature of this country, unhelpful. What would be the message if you were to boil it down? We're giving you a show on Fox to follow him. What would be the message? I mean, how do you express the reality of this, of the nuance that's associated with the fluidity of these characters?
Well, okay. It would be something like, what's the assimilation that we can see today resembles that of the American past. And it's a basis for building out. And it is not, you know, it's not something that, and, you know, this is really a problem not just on the right, I have to say. It's also, I think, a problem on the left. And, you know, the critical race theory is definitely valuable for its insights into how systemic racism functions in American society. But it is not a comprehensive way of looking at and understanding what's going on in the U.S. today. So I think on both sides, there's a tendency to lop off today from the past, to not see how they in fact are related, that today can be understood as continuing patterns of the past that we accept, that we think we're good. So it would be something like that.
And I mean, just lastly, just on that critical race theory aspect, what is the limitation of that that perspective?
First of all, it's been mainly tested on the African American experience, and I think that it best applies to the African American experience. And you know, it's not that it's inapplicable in some respects to dark-skinned Hispanics or others, but it simply isn't a we can't think of the world as divided between whites and people of color. That's really a bad starting point.
Because of the fluidity of, yes, of both those categories.
Correct.
It's fascinating work. Richard Alba, the book is The Great Demographic Illusion, Majority Minority in the Expanding American Mainstream. Thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much. It was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back to wrap things up in a moment. We've got to, when we come back, we're going to just talk about what's happening or not happening at the Supreme Court, which could fundamentally alter the woman's right to choose and have sovereignty over her body in this country. And this is going to go down in the next, or not go down in the next 48 hours. We'll be right back to talk about that for a moment. Okay, we got just a couple of minutes here to wrap things up, but I wanted to we've talked about this law, SB 8, in Texas.
Yeah.
This is a law that was passed that essentially deputized in the past states that wanted to curtail abortion, wanted to basically outlaw abortion, ran into this problem where they would outlaw abortion more or less, you know, based upon, you know, against Roe v. Wade. And someone or some entity would sue the state who was, or a specific official who was to enforce this law. And then it would ultimately work its way up through the federal courts and it would be struck down. It would either be struck down at the appellate level or ultimately the Supreme Court. You know, you have things like trap laws. Now, the Supreme Court's gone a little wobbly on trap laws. Trap laws being targeted restrictions on abortion providers.
And we should say that the entire purpose of most of these laws was just throw whatever at the wall and see what sticks. And so maybe the Supreme Court will, on an off chance, disregard precedent with Roe and, you know.
Yes, and I would also add, also, there were times where they would be okay with it, and it would be, the right to get an abortion would still be there, but the actual ability to get an abortion in certain states basically all but eliminated.
Right, your clinic needs to be this exact square footage and ceiling height.
You need to have
height.
Admitting privileges, yeah. and whatnot. So Texas came up with an innovative way of skirting around the idea of who has standing. And that is, they empowered citizens to bring civil lawsuits against abortion providers. Plaintiffs could make up to $10,000 by suing somebody for allowing someone to have an abortion or providing one.
How that affects the other person is dubious.
Right, and this is SB 8. Now, yeah. The thing is that they were able to get around federal courts because you don't have a member of the state suing a state official.
Mm-hmm.
So on Friday, the Fifth Circuit of the U.S. Court of Appeals was supposed to have a trial judge hearing on SB 8's constitutionality, but they canceled it because the federal courts felt like we couldn't deal with this because this is a civil lawsuit under state law and it's not our jurisdiction. And so they can't quite figure out where to bring this case, or plaintiffs can't. They sent it to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court, and this law takes effect September 1st in Texas.
Which is tomorrow.
Which is tomorrow. So now we're down to about 24 hours. The Supreme Court could hear this and issue an emergency stay of this law. But if they don't, Texas will have effectively overturn Roe v. Wade. Abortion providers in Texas will be sued and could have their places shut down because they could be sued as an abettor to abortion. It also, SB 8 triggers mandatory closures of these abortion clinics. And right now, we're waiting to see if any type of federal district court will weigh in or if Supreme Court will. And
the effective ban, too, it bans it past 6 weeks, which is essentially like you could get pregnant. 4 weeks later, you miss your period. Oftentimes, women don't know that they miss their period minimum of a week later. That's when you get concerned at a minimum. And so it's like basically an abortion ban because you would have to immediately know that you're pregnant, which some tests don't even see that, then get an abortion in that tiny, tiny window. It's a completely ridiculous undue burden.
So keep an eye out for that. We'll know more in the next 24 hours. We will obviously talk about it tomorrow. So if you're watching us on Peacock, we will say goodbye. And if you're watching us not on Peacock, which is undoubtedly the case, then I say hello. And I also say you can support this program by becoming a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. You can help this show survive and thrive. What do you think about that?
I think we had like 30 seconds left. That's why I was going on and on. But regardless, that's fine.
No, you weren't going on and on. Oh, okay. Do we still have 30 seconds?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry.
Oh, I didn't see that in the... No, I thought we landed that perfectly.
Oh.
Oh, yeah. I had a different clock on there. Hmm. You can help the show survive and thrive by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, don't forget our email. Our email blast every day, the AM Quickie newsletter. You can sign up for that at majority.fm. Scroll all the way to the bottom. Quick read gives you a good sense of the stories of the day. Anything you may have missed on the show gives you a preview of what you're going to see on the show to that day.
Right.
So check that out. Also, don't forget our Discord. And Friday, sun's out, guns out.
Mm-hmm.
We had some people who were sending us some suggestions as to how we can help Afghan refugees. Not quite sure how we're going to do that. May just make a call for it over the course of the show as I get the suns out, guns out. May do the flex thing.
Yeah,
do but the I don't want to stress. I don't want to pull anything.
I'll do a flex.
Hurt my muscle. But we will endeavor to do something like that.
How about for every $100, I give some fantasy football advice. I know the audience would love that.
But we could do that too. That I have a feeling would probably drive a lot more cash.
I don't know if that's true, right? We'll see.
Do we have Nomi? Yeah.
We also, there's, I just wanted to encourage people to donate to some of these mutual aid funds that are in New Orleans, at Mutual Aid Louisiana as well, as we're talking about some of these Afghan refugee places to donate. That's also another good place where people definitely need help right now.
We'll put a link to that at majority.fm in our YouTube and our podcast description. Nomi!
Hello, welcome back from your vacay.
Thank you very much. Well, I like your, now you have art behind you now.
It's very new every fancy. Time. It's new every time.
Constantly
wandering around trying to figure out how to confuse you guys. It's actually just the same place, and I have it's a game. That's what it is.
I like that the calling card is that sort of purple.
Me too.
Hue.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
It's a nice little thing because it make any room the studio.
Yeah, it does. I like that idea.
We just need working Wi-Fi, and That's the whole thing.
Which you get 50% of the time.
Yeah. I mean, you could be in New York and lose your power and not have Wi-Fi. Or you could be in Puerto Rico. You never know.
I've never lost my power in New York.
You've never?
Really?
Not yet.
Wow. Look at you. You're not a real New Yorker yet, then.
I guess not. Yeah.
Nomi, what's happening on your show this week?
We got a lot on our show. So we have two shows, Wednesdays and Fridays, obviously. But Wednesday, we have Anthony Conwright, who is wrote a piece called American Education is Founded on White Race Theory. And then later, we have Maximilian Alvarez, who hosts the he has his podcast, but he also did a piece called The Pandemic Made the Divide Between the Ruling and Working Class Clearer Than Ever. And then later, we have Natalie Scherr and Jordan Zacharin to talk about all the stuff that's happening this week, from Afghanistan to climate, you name it.
Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
A couple things. There's patron content. Robert McPherson, David Griscom, and I talked about television production and unionizing that more, or like expanding labor protections at least. And also, we talked about Radio Free Tom Nichols, the time he called me a snowflake because I said that actually $7.25 isn't a good enough minimum wage to work at McDonald's, even if it motivates you to get a better job. So that's for patrons. And also, after this show, I'll be raiding on Twitch, the Left Reckoning Twitch feed, because David Griscom is doing his Griscom stream this afternoon.
Whoa. Like raiding, R-A-I-D?
R-A-I-D-I-N-G.
Don't you know anything about Twitch?
No, it's poggers.
Poggers.
Hype train. Level 7,000, bitch.
Wow. Things have really changed around here since I was gone for a week. Things really have really changed.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Fun half. You can IM us via the app. You can get the app at majorityapp.com. See you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
And the alpha males are back. Boy is back. And the alpha males are back.
Just want to degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back. Back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Can you bring back DJ Dinner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Dinner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs, they look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych. Fuck them.
Snowflake says what? What? Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bang. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back. And the Africans are black African. And the alpha males are black. And the Africans are back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keeping it 100. Can't knock the hustle.
Come on! Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday. Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back. Africans are black. Alpha males are black.
It's a blasphemy around here.
I am a total pussy.